This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, a lawyer turned science mystery author.
Money and lives are at stake in modern genetics, and there's a lot of competition. We're making decisions that will affect the health and well-being and even the genetic makeup of the next generation. Really thought it would be intriguing to bring that all together in thriller form.
Coming up, how Laurie Andrews turns real science into thriller novels. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and this is The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. In news this week, embryonic stem cells reveal the mechanism for the fragile X gene mutation. The scientist Andrea Garleski has more.
Researchers at Hebrew University in Jerusalem found that the mutated gene in fragile X syndrome functions normally in early embryogenesis, but is silenced by cell differentiation. The mutation in the FMR1 gene is the most common form of genetic mental retardation. A combination of methylation and deacetylation at the promoter region of the FMR1 gene that occurs after differentiation appears to play a role in silencing the gene. The authors said that looking at the gene's role in development was impossible until taking advantage of embryonic stem cells. Robert Lanza of Advanced Cell Technology in Los Angeles, California, who was not involved in the research, said that such an approach has been overshadowed by the focus on developing stem cells as treatments for various disorders.
That was Andrea Garleski reporting from The Scientist Daily News. You can read all our news stories on our website, thescientist.com. Next, senior editor Allison McCook speaks with mystery writer Laurie Andrews about her latest book, The Silent Assassin. After writing 10 nonfiction books, Andrews turned to science mystery writing with her first novel, Sequence. It's not her only career. Andrews is a lawyer and genetics expert who directs the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Her books don't shy away from technical terms, science-specific issues, and cutting-edge techniques in molecular biology and genetics. Andrews told McCook how she got into science.
Amazingly, up to one quarter of medical schools still don't have classes for teaching genetics. And so among the things that I've done to get brought up to speed on genetics is to take courses they give for doctors who didn't go to a medical school that actually teaches it as a separate course. So I've learned about it that way. I took some courses at Yale Medical School while I was in law school. And then I learned a lot while I served on an Institute of Medicine committee dealing with assessing genetic risk, and also as chair of the committee that dealt with the ethical implications of the Human Genome Project. So I spent a lot of time behind closed doors in scientific laboratories and government laboratories and at biotech companies.
So did you take these classes knowing that you wanted to write a novel with a scientist as protagonist, or did that come out of the classes?
I took these classes to be able to deal with cutting-edge legal issues. And in fact, governments have called me in all over the world for advice on things like whether gene patenting should be allowed or whether they would need a different family law system if they started doing reproductive cloning for human beings. And so I needed to know the medical background to be able to talk about things like whether health insurers should be able to discriminate based on people's genotype. Unless you know that a test is very good, you might not want it incorporated into clinical medical practice, for example. But it was my visits to the laboratories that really got me interested in writing about writing fiction with a scientific character. Money and lives are at stake in modern genetics, and there's a lot of competition. We're making decisions that will affect the health and well-being and even the genetic makeup of the next generation. And I really thought it would be intriguing to bring that all together in thriller form.
And what's interesting is your character, Alexandra Blake, she's associated with a group that worked out the genetic sequence of the 1918 Spanish flu. It's a real group of scientists, correct?
Right. I'm very excited about my mystery series with the book's sequence and the silent assassin because they take place in a real facility, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, which does forensic investigations for the military and the executive branch, develops new means of testing. It's attached on the same campus as Walter Reed Medical Center, where returning soldiers and some politicians get their care. And also, it shares the grounds with a medical museum that deals with the history of science. And so it's a fabulous place for a series because nefarious things can happen to this fictionalized group in that in the setting of a museum or a hospital or a modern-day pathology lab. So I have access to a place where scientific advances are made, but also where diseases and crimes are investigated.
So, and you spent time at those labs specifically because you provide some great details about the museum and what the labs look like and also this battle going on to move the museum to another site. Is that real? Is that really happening?
Yes. All of this is based in facts, like the fact that the Air Force Institute of Pathology is the place where they sequenced the Spanish flu genome. And in the fictionalized version, my character is a Berkeley assistant professor of molecular biology who gets lured there to work on the Spanish flu genome, but reluctantly gets dragged into forensic investigation and finds that she can use some of her unique skills to actually take that investigation forward. And I was intrigued in part because I'd read an article in a scientific journal saying that there was a real lack of laboratory literature. You either had, you know, a mad scientist or someone who was very antisocial. And my character, Alex Blake, has a boyfriend who's a musician and wears cowboy boots to work and, you know, has sex, you know, a lot of different things that you don't see in literature where the scientist is, you know, portrayed as someone kind of leading to the downfall of society.
Yeah, I mean, she really comes off as any other protagonist, any other hero of a crime novel. Sometimes you almost don't think of her as a scientist as much as sort of the hero of the piece.
And yet, you know, there are quirks she has. I mean, when she's nervous, she, you know, taps her fingers almost like a piano player, but what she's tapping out is the ATCG of the genetic code of something she's thinking about. So she very much has the, you know, kind of rational scientific approach in contrast, say, to the brief glimpses you get of her mother, who's a cultural anthropologist and a little more funky.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And I also was fascinated by the specificity of the issues that you brought up in terms of the tool names of what she was using, something from Applied Biosystems, or this issue of, I know in sequence it comes up as that the Institute is cutting back on journal subscriptions because they're so expensive. Those are things that you really only hear about within the scientific community. Have you gotten reactions from non-scientists to those kinds of issues? Did it resonate with them? Did they respond?
You know, I think that non-scientists felt a little more enabled to understand what goes on at a scientific institution. And I've used the books in part to try to take a really good yarn in a way and smuggle in some important social issue about science. Sometimes it deals with scientific funding and, as you say, cutting back on journal subscriptions. But other times it has to do with the use of science. Like there's a very strong feeling that my character, Dr. Blake, has about genetic privacy. And so in a forensic search, one of the sailors in the Navy doesn't want to give Dr. Blake his DNA because he's afraid she'll test for the so-called gay gene and he'll get bounced out of the military. And so there really, you know, cutting-edge issues about how far we go with our genetic knowledge, but also giving readers a better sense of, you know, how we even get there. What does it take to, you know, take DNA out of a sample and sequence it, for example?
Yeah, and there's this ongoing debate that we've covered about how scientists should communicate to the public. And many people say, you know, eliminate all jargon, sort of argue that the public doesn't think about things the way a scientist does. But what I found amazing about your books is that you don't shy away from talking about mitochondrial DNA. And you describe it, but then you keep talking about it, where that's a term, and the idea of getting DNA from samples and the difficulties associated with that. You don't shy away from using these very technical scientific terms. Have you gotten any response from readers about that who aren't scientists? Do they stumble over it? Is it something they enjoy, actually being exposed to terms they normally aren't?
Yeah, readers have very much enjoyed taking a glimpse inside the scientific world and learning some of the terminology. I think that's why many people from all walks of life are drawn to mysteries. You know, you can read a mystery and learn about Native Americans or about chefs and so forth. People come to it not only because they have a real sense of right or wrong that gets played out in a mystery, but also because they generally learn about some setting or occupation, and it's just not so often been, you know, turned toward science. I think I have obviously written a lot of books about science policy. In fact, I'd written 10 nonfiction books before turning to writing a mystery. And the toughest thing for me is that I realized I'd always written about concepts, and I had no sense of the physical. You know, so my first version of the first book, you know, people could get shot and be in the conversation 5 seconds later. I had to go back and from the beginning and revise everything to think about where people were situated, what their, you know, what their health and condition was like, you know, were they tired and so forth. And so it's been a really interesting experience for me to sort of imbue characters with more realistic traits.
It sounds like you've been able to do what you said readers like to do with mysteries, is come to a new situation and learn all about it, the way you did all your research before actually jumping into the series.
Yes, and I, you know, the latest book, The Silent Assassin, actually took me to modern-day Vietnam and to...
Did you get to travel there for the book?
Yes, I traveled there for the book. I mean, I went to a very interesting plant biology research facility there. But that book, The Silent Assassin, the idea came to me when I was at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and I was being led around by someone who had given me his resume, and he had an article on the resume called The Vietnamese Trophy Skulls. And I asked what they were, and he opened up a drawer and put a human skull in my hand that had graffiti on it and had been made into a candle holder. There was a whole drawer full of these skulls, and they had been confiscated from returning Vietnam War veterans who were trying to bring them back into this country. And so I started out my book, The Silent Assassin, by asking, you know, what if the government of Vietnam asked for those skulls back? You know, what could Alex, my character, learn about them? You know, could you get enough DNA to match up with family members? You know, what do we owe the dead, in a sense? What do we owe our enemies? And throughout the series, as I'm working on it, the whole area of the science around genetics has been so fascinating to deal with, because you can take all sorts of highly emotional storylines and play with them and bring in ideas of nature versus nurture and things that are really ever intriguing to people.
I didn't realize that those skulls were real.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, you read the whole book, and so there's actually a lot more in my books that is real than you think. You know, the characters are fictional, and it's been fun to create a character, because you get to do a do-over of your own life, in a way. my mother actually was very disappointed when I went to Yale Law School because she wanted me to be a beautician. And because she thought a lawyer, that's not going to help her out at all, but if she's a beautician, at least I could do her hair. So I have this highly rational scientist, very well-trained MD from Columbia, PhD from there as well, as my main character. But as a nod to my mother, she lives in a beauty salon called the Curl Up and Die.
That's funny. I didn't realize there was any personal connection to the salon, because it's really a unique setting. You can picture it so well, even though it's such a bizarre place for someone to live.
Yeah, and I really do think it will, the whole series might get people excited about science and make it seem like certain genetic concepts are more accessible than they thought they were in the past.
And I also was fascinated to see that in sequence especially, molecular biology saves the day. I mean, I don't want to reveal the ending, but
sure.
The science and the intricate nature of the work that Alex was doing is what ultimately solved everything. That requires, to me, it seems, a very sophisticated understanding of what's going on scientifically. Did you consult with other scientists and say, is this a possible, you know, next step here? Would this actually be something that could technically happen?
Yes. You know, I've tried to make sure, you know, even when I give Alex a technology that's maybe a few years out, that it's based on very possible things. I'm just finishing up the manuscript for the next book in this series, and I've had to learn a huge amount about monoclonal antibodies, and also I decided to have a computer that runs on DNA in it. And so I've had to be in touch with various laboratories and read all the literature on what becomes possible if you replace the 0-1 binary code in a computer with the ability to have just this higher degree of replication and much faster possibility with the 4 base pairs.
Wow, that's fascinating. And that was one of my questions, too, about whether there's going to be another book in the series. And do you have an idea of when that could be coming out?
It'll probably be out in about 9 months. It's actually due to the publisher tomorrow.
Wow.
So, in it, Alex does work around something that may indeed be a new emerging infectious disease, could be biowarfare. And so, I mean, I'm really going through a variety of different potential applications of genetics with respect to my various storylines.
And do you have a sense of who your readership is? Is it mostly non-scientists or scientists?
You know, there are many scientists. I've gotten a lot of emails from scientists from NIH and National Cancer Institute and so forth. And it's you know, very, very interesting what people, you know, pick up on in the book. And, you know, you do all of a sudden have people writing to you from all over the world, from people who, you know, grew up 70 years ago in the neighborhood that now is the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and want to tell me what it's like then, to, you know, people who want to suggest what guns should be, to, you know, researchers who are interested in commenting on the techniques that I've put forth in the book. I mean, and there's an international interest, and Sequence, it came out in Europe in several languages this past summer, and I went on radio shows in Berlin about it, and it was very, very intriguing because there the interviewers all read both my nonfiction books on the subject and the mystery, and asked me really, really interesting questions about whether, for example, my having a young character who's deaf but is incredibly competent, is related to my stand against, you know, genetic engineering, for example. So they were making connections that might have actually been subconscious between my nonfiction work and what I'm trying to do in this genetic thriller series.
So you weren't conscious of any kind of relationship between the two, but it seems, based on your description, that there very well could be.
Yes. I mean, I was conscious of the fact that in each book I smuggle in some little theme, like the genetic privacy issue or repatriation of remains, that I think is important in the policy sphere and with my work generally. But I haven't thought, well, you know, based on everything I've learned about the possibility of actually manipulating the genes in the next generation, what would I value? And I think those are the subconscious things that come out, in addition to the fact that it ends up when you're writing, you can put a little bit of yourself or a little bit of your friends in a whole variety of characters. The scientist is part me, but so is the lawyer. The lawyer, Alex's friend Barbara, is very focused. She comes completely prepared to meetings with stacks of paper, and that's part of my personality. But I also have a part that's like Alex, where she thinks if anything comes up at the meeting, she can just jot it on the back of a cash station receipt, you know.
That was novelist Laurie Andrews speaking with the scientist Allison McCook. Read more about Andrews' books on our website. You can also see a slideshow from one of the places where Andrews' book sequence takes place, and that's the National Museum of Health and Medicine. The museum's director, Adrian Noe, is a contributing editor to The Scientist, and you can see pictures of their microscope collection at thescientist.com. While you're there, check out daily updates from our news team on research, breakthroughs, and policy that affects your world. That's all for The Scientist podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.